House Judiciary, House Committee on Judiciary, come to order. Today is Monday, February 13th, 2017. We're going to go slightly out of order. Somebody has to, a witness has to be at another event shortly, so we'll open a public hearing on House Bill 2460. And today, none of the bills are ready to be worked. They're not ready to go, so we'll just be having public hearings today.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2460 authorizes a school bus driver to operate a video recording device on a school bus to record drivers who fail to stop for the school bus's safety lights. The bill allows a police officer to review the video and issue a citation while providing the registered owner of the vehicle to whom the citation is issued the ability to submit a certificate of innocence or a certificate of non-liability. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Michael Cape and Jim Kozel. Please. And you can go in either order, but be sure you identify yourself so for the record. It's recorded.
Thank you, Chairman Barker and members of the committee. My name is Michael Cape. 1112 Goucher Street, Amity, Oregon. That's what I would do at our council meetings when I have people giving public testimony. So this is a bill that's important to me, the job that I get paid for, actually, when I'm not working for my city is as a school bus driver. I started that about 6 years ago when my daughter was in kindergarten because I wanted to be around her more. So I gave up teaching and the headaches of being a teacher to have the headaches of being a school bus driver. There's a lot of good things about being a school bus driver and a lot of bad things. You got to deal with traffic and all the behaviors that kids like to have on a school bus. But by far the biggest problem that I have encountered as a bus driver is when we go to let students off the bus or get them onto the bus and keeping those kids safe. And that's what this bill is hopefully going to address. As hopefully everybody's aware, when those red lights come on the bus, that nice little stop arm comes out with the red lights, traffic is supposed to stop and so that the kids can get on and off the bus safely. And unfortunately, in today's society, that just does not happen nearly enough. There too frequently, cars don't stop. Even with the lights on, I'll use the air horn if I have to try and get the driver's attention, and that doesn't work a lot of times. And once they finally look over, because they hear the ruckus, you can see this, just a look of blankness on their face. On so many drivers, just unaware that there was a school bus and what's going on and that the kids are trying to get on and off. And I've talked with some of the kids that ride my bus. Their father is a state trooper and has been involved in some, I don't know if stings are the correct technical term in today's day and age, to try and catch people that do run those red lights. And he said that, you know, when we pull those people over and we talk to them and ask them about it and ask them, you know, do you know why you're being pulled over? Not even a clue. And they ask, well, there was a school bus back there with its red lights on. And he said, they're like, what? Just unaware that it was even there. And so I don't like trying to penalize people for actions retroactively, like this case. But we need to change driver behavior somehow. And if the best way to do so is by catching them and breaking the law and then providing the punishment that they should be getting under Oregon law, then we need to do that, I think. And currently, Oregon's law, the ORS, does not allow that to happen very easily. If the police officer witnesses it, they can obviously write a citation on the spot. If they do not witness it, ORS 811.159 states that they can only write a letter of warning. And to do that, The bus driver has to be able to document the location, date, time, license plate, make, model of the vehicle, and hopefully a description of some kind of the driver. All the while, you're, as the driver of the school bus, making sure the right kids are getting on or off the bus. The ones that are already or are staying on the bus are behaving. You're watching the traffic, you're watching the mirrors, and trying to do that is extremely difficult. I would hope everybody could imagine. And I just want to make the law changed a little bit to make it easier for our police to enforce it. And to me, that's what this is about, making it so that our police can enforce the law. And we have technology to make it easier to happen. So if I could, I'd also like to mention a little mini field trip today. I brought my daughter, no school bus, but I brought my daughter. She's in the back of the room here doing a little bit of homework. But I thought it'd be a good chance for her to learn about the legislative process, which she's starting to learn a little bit about in school.
Hey, well, thank you. We welcome to be here
for the day off.
Okay. Are there any questions?
Yeah.
Representative Post.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm glad we had a bus driver here because I wrote a question in my notes here that would be great if I had a bus driver here to ask this question. And you kind of answered part of it with what you said you would have to do now. So I'm trying to picture. So you're on the bus. You've got the door open. The kids are coming in, sitting down. All the stuff's going on. And you see somebody go by. You try to note the license plate, the description, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And maybe you don't have the answer to this question. If we do a video recorder system, is it going to be something like the red light cameras where it'll automatically go off and record that? Is that what we're talking about? Or because I don't want one more thing for you to have to exactly what you described. I didn't, when I read this, thinking, oh my goodness, they're worried about the kids and safety and all these things. Oh, and I got to push a button on a camera.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Post, exactly. That's the way the camera systems are designed and how they operate. They typically come completely loaded with a GPS program so they can mark the location, date, time. And when the bus is typically the way they work anyways, they can, I believe they can kind of function a little bit differently based on manufacturer and in-house program. But typically when the bus is running, it's recording. And when the driver witnesses an incident, it's already continuously recording, and the driver can just push a single button on the dash, and that will flag or mark the video so that then when the driver gets back to their location, they can download the video or report it to their supervisor. Some systems download that video automatically, and then they can review that video, determine if they felt that there was a violation, and at that point, that's what we're looking at, is that video could then be emailed to the police for further enforcement. But the important part with that button to flag it, then you don't have to review 80 hours of tape for a 15-second violation.
Sure. Okay, thanks. Very small follow-up. Then, as a bus driver, in your opinion, this would make your life easier?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Post, most definitely, yes. Pushing one button is easy, and more importantly, like I said, I think the hope is that driver behavior would change, and then I wouldn't be pushing that button very much at all.
All right, thank you.
Thank you. Representative Springer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I do have a question along these lines, but who all do we have testifying on this? Because I have some particulars.
We have one more driver. We have one more driver testifying and two people from the Department of Education.
Okay. Thank you. So to follow up on that a little bit, when I was on the school board, we had the cameras in there. We had a box up there. And frankly, we didn't have enough cameras, couldn't afford all of them. So the box was always there. Maybe it had a camera, maybe it didn't have a camera. But it was up above here. And I can't wrap my head around how the view to the back of the bus is now turning this way, out the driver's window, out the front windshield, right, to get. Now, are you talking about more cameras? I'm wondering about expense here.
Chairman and Representative Springer, yes. There currently is not any reporting to of what schools, number of cameras that they have on buses and things like that. I would say the vast majority of public schools in Oregon do have some kind of monitoring system inside the bus, directed inside the bus to monitor student behavior and maybe driver behavior. And so what we're looking to do is add cameras, yes, to the outside of the bus. And yes, you're right, that can be an additional cost. And I would say it's very difficult to determine what that cost could be. Like I said, some schools that already have camera systems, it may be as simple as adding two cameras, which might be about $500. Some schools, like the one that I work for, a private school, we don't have any camera system at all. So you're probably looking at about $2,000 to $3,000 per bus for that.
Thank you. Thank just you. A bit of a follow-up. I don't think that this is really a fair question for you, sir. A couple of the things that I'm wrestling with here is, first of all, we also need to now, I'm assuming, because it's the bus driver who's witnessing it and attesting to the validity of the video recording, bus drivers going to find themselves in court in the middle of the day testifying on tickets. So we need to factor that in as far as cost of subs and so forth. The other piece is it isn't typical to have an officer sign a citation except when they view the violation, like you said earlier, or as a result of an accident. So we just need to think about the precedent that we're setting here. I'm on board with where you want to get to, for sure. I think we just need to think about these other pieces and how much we're adding to be done, and can we do this right and well. And again, those aren't fair questions to you as far as the time in court and how the law enforcement piece of that is, but those are certainly questions I need to have answered at some point.
Okay, thank you. Representative Corson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. First, I want to thank you for bringing this to our attention, and it's nice to see people take such an interest that they're willing to come down and testify here, or maybe it's come up. I don't remember where you're located. The one thing that I would say, though, is I'm, like Representative Springer, the cost is a factor, and I know that, you know, child safety is the issue that we're talking about. So I probably will have a question for our friends from Department of Education, but I wanted to thank you for being here today.
Thank you. Any further questions? Okay, please go ahead.
Jim Kozel from Mount Angel, also a school bus driver. Since I retired about 10 years ago, I've been driving a school bus. And in an earlier life, when I was going to college, I drove a school bus too. So I've got about 18 years of experience driving school bus. And I agree with a lot of what he says. In other words, part of what you were asking about, okay, let me back up a bit. Okay. I drive about 85 miles a day, mostly in rural roads in North Marion County and in South Clackamas County. And some of it are on State Highway 213 and State Highway 214, but others are on many of the county roads, which there's no fog lines, not even a lane wide, and so forth. The kids, I transport about 120 kids a day. One of the things, the questions that you would ask is about how to record the information. Well, at least in the company I work for, you have a sheet of paper and you're supposed to record a description of the car. And when you're spending all this time watching the students and so forth, you don't have time to figure out what your car that is, other than it's four-door and it's black. And you've got to try and get a license plate number, otherwise they can't do anything. So the cameras would probably be an optimum way to go. And from what I have heard is that the cameras, an extra camera would possibly go on the outside of the bus. That way you can catch cars and then be on the left side near where that stop sign that goes out. And that the cameras would catch vehicles coming from either direction. And so that way you would be hopefully get a good view of the license plate of the vehicle. And then you can say, yep, when you take it and download it, yep, that was the car. And all you have to do is remember about the approximate time and the date, and you've got your data as was requested in what I saw in this 2460 bill. I have one section of Highway 213 between the Markham area and heading up towards Malala, about one mile length section of mostly winding with virtually no shoulders on 213. And I have six stops of anywhere between one and six kids getting off or getting on at these stops. Three of them are crosses. And you're sitting there, and what we do is we'll let the kids get off the bus, but they go up to that arm that comes out, the stop arm, and they stand there until we signal them to go across. And you don't know if that car, especially the ones coming towards you, is going to stop or not. And you're holding there, and you're holding them there. And finally, the car comes to stop. Then you release them to cross the road. A lot of them don't. Some of them are on cell phones, and you still can miss a stop school bus. But we need something better to take care of these violators. And I think it needs an attitudinal change, too, on the part of the drivers in the state. If I can share some additional information, in the first couple years I was doing this, Clackamas County Sheriff would come out in the area on 213 once a month with a patrol car, and they would set up a radar unit usually once a month, usually in the morning, but sometimes during the afternoon when the kids were going home. And OSP would do the same thing. But then because of the change, the needs of the departments and probably funding and so forth, that has gone away. And I can say, at least on Highway 213 in particular, speeds have picked up, and they don't even slow down for the 20 mile an hour in front of a Butte Creek school at all. So I think if we were to have cameras on the buses, people would become more aware and might be slowing down when they come through the schools and see the buses stopping. And I do support this bill.
Thank you. Are there any questions? Thank you very much, and thank you for coming down and testifying.
Okay,
I know
you
need to get back to
the bus route. I've got to go take the kids home now.
Yeah.
Thank you for hearing me early.
Okay, thank you. Jan McComb and TJ Crockett, please.
Good afternoon, Chair Barker, members of the committee. For the record, I am Jan McComb, the Legislative Director for the Department of Education, and with me is TJ Crockett. He's the department's Pupil Transportation Director. As you may know, ODE is tasked with developing and training and safety standards for school buses and drivers. Passage of this law will allow ODE to develop a standard for cameras that may be placed on the outside of the school bus to capture violations. Over 1,300 daily violations in Oregon occur in the 2014-15 school year. The department's neutral on the bill, but when we read through it, we saw some opportunity for some technical amendments, perhaps, and TJ is going to review those for you.
Okay.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, my name is TJ Crockett, for the record. As Jan mentioned, we do one-day student load counts, and that's how we get to this 13. It's actually more than 1,300 violations in a day through the year. And that's clearly when students are most at risk, right? School buses are built to a high standard. They're designed to win the crash. They're designed to keep people inside. So loading and unloading is the most dangerous time that we have with the kids when it relates to school buses. So putting cameras on the outside does make some sense if this is a driver behavior that we wish to change. We would recommend, though, in regards to law, a system that doesn't require driver input. To talk a little bit to Representative Post's question, there are camera manufacturers out there now that do have automatic capabilities. We have seen some districts attempt to put the same cameras that are inside the bus just mounted on the outside to collect video, and those are always on and recording, so you'd have to do something in order to activate it. The stop arm cameras, if you wanted to Google it, is how they're termed out in the world, and they are automatic. They have motion sensors on them. They tend to become activated when the amber lights of the bus are activated. They start recording, and then they capture a video along with still frame pictures that then can be submitted to law enforcement. So one of the other technical areas I guess I would ask for you guys to consider is whether or not the initial report has to include video or if it could begin with photo. The photo captures the car, captures the license plate. Depending on the manufacturer, sometimes it would take a picture of the driver. Some do, some don't. That's another item I think you would want to consider as you look at this bill. But then they link back to a video. So with a partnership between a school or a school district and law enforcement would allow them with that report to have access to the video as part of their investigation. And then they could issue citations in the same manner that they do with red light cameras at traffic lights or for photo radar, as you guys have allowed in statute in that way. Another area, though, that is different than photo radar or photo red light is that the school bus driver actually has some input into this particular violation. They have an obligation in the statutes, 811, 515, section 12, to operate those safety lights in a particular manner. They have to provide 100 to 300 feet of warning before they go. So I think the committee should look at that, make sure that that makes sense in the context of this mill. Perhaps there's an affirmative defense if the driver didn't provide enough warning times. There are times where drivers are not able to, I think I'm leaving the stop and I see Johnny running. Well, I need to stop traffic again. But that first car, it might be too late for them because they started to go. So I don't know that that's necessarily a fair situation to issue a citation for, but those situations do exist out in the world. And then the one thing I also do want to point out is since this is supplemental equipment for a school bus for districts that are eligible for state school fund distributions, this camera would be reimbursed out of state school fund as with other transportation expenses. And I'm happy to entertain any questions you have.
Okay, any questions for the witnesses? Yep. Yes, Representative Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Did you two submit this language for LC to craft, or do you?
Chair Barker, Vice Chair Olson, we did send an email to Josh, and we would be happy to work with him on that.
Oh, so you might be the one I want to ask some questions of then. Well, let me just throw this out. Where are you at for the permissive side of this? I mean, that one, the driver may report it within 72 hours. Police officer, upon receiving all the evidence, may issue a citation. Curious your take on that. Follow up.
Chair Barker, Representative Olson, members of the committee. The current language matches what law allows, so drivers now may submit reports to law enforcement agencies who then may send letters based on their investigation. I do think a little bit of driver discretion is warranted for the example that I cited earlier. Maybe for one reason or another, I didn't activate my lights on time, so I'd like to not start this process. So I think it is important that the driver have some input in it. As far as the law enforcement piece, I can't truly speak for that. I think that law enforcement needs to look at the evidence and make decisions in the best interest of the community.
Okay, the follow-up. I got a series of questions to ask. Thanks. Okay, Jan, you mentioned that there was over. Did I get this right? You said 1,300 violations a day.
Chair Barker, Representative Olson. Yes, that is correct. We do a one-day sample annually. And it was a little more than 1,350 is what the number was that we got back. We also don't get 100% of bus drivers reporting back on that report. It's part of a report done by the National Association of State Directors of Pupil Transportation Services. They do nationwide reports. Oh. And Oregon's daily total, if that sample is true, and I can't say it's scientific because we're asking bus drivers on a one-day sample, comes back 1,300 a day.
Just follow up on that. So I'd be curious to know when that sample is taken, because obviously during the seasonal makes a big difference, I think, for what the outcome is on that, whether it be, you know, 6:30, 7 o'clock in the morning versus that of when it's just bright lights out, that type of thing with the sun. Okay, so I just follow with me, and Josh, you might want to help me out on this one, too, a little bit. On the front page of this, it's section 2 that I'm looking at. And it's actually line 23. It says a citation is mailed to the registered owner of the vehicle within 6 business days of the alleged violation. So we know that the mail goes out. But I've turned to the second page, and I'm down on line 25 of the second page, keeping in mind that a citation has been mailed. and now we're talking about default judgment here, this section. If the person named as the registered owner of the vehicle is in current records of the Department of Transportation, fails to respond to a citation issued under subsection 3 of this section, a default judgment is entered into failure to appear. Here's my problem. There's not anybody up here that hasn't been in law enforcement that has not stumbled on multiple times of somebody who has sold a vehicle, and then all of a sudden that person who purchased that vehicle fails to transfer the title. Better yet, the original owner maybe even gave them a bill of sale and then moves out of the state. What happens with that? I mean, this to me, I see this is really kind of being a little bit of a rub right now.
Mr. Chair, Representative Olson, the bill is modeled on existing red light photos and photo radar provisions in the law. And so that's just as a preface. The answer to your question, though, is the bill provides registered owners of vehicles the opportunity to submit a certificate of innocence. So you've got 30 days to do that. That's in page 2, line 6.
I saw that.
Mm-hmm. So you've got 30 days to submit that I wasn't driving, I sold the car, that kind of a thing. And then the court's required to dismiss it upon you submitting that. And my recollection, which I'm verifying now, is it's a sworn statement, so you'd be potentially exposing yourself to perjury for lying in the certificate of innocence.
Okay. Thank you.
Representative Springer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I thought, Representative Olson, you were going to get all of my question, but just a step further from that, and keep in mind, there is not a red light camera in my district, so I haven't dealt with that. We do have lights in our district, my district, but we don't have a red light camera.
And so kerosene, lit by kerosene, but go ahead.
Maybe we do. What if we do? So as I looked at this, and Representative Olson, you were going there, it's mailed to the person. I didn't see certified mail.
Right.
Mail sometimes doesn't get there. A person could end up with a suspended license on this. And so that's, Josh, mm-hmm. please speak to that if you could. That concerns me.
Chair Barker, Representative Springer, one thing I would say in response to that is the Oregon Rules of Civil Procedure have a inadvertent mistake provision, so that if I were, let's say I failed to respond in time, I could apply to the court to reopen the case.
After I got stopped by the cops and found out my license was suspended because they ran me.
Chair Barker, Representative Springer.
And my insurance was upset and cost me more.
I'd be more than happy to have an amendment drafted requiring it to be mailed by certified mail, if that would help.
They don't mail certified mail now. That makes sense. Representative Weininger.
Thank you. Thanks so much for being here. I have a question about how long the records would be retained for. So I think the bill as currently drafted, or at least one of the witnesses who testified talked about the bill having cameras that were on all the time that the bus was running. Is there a provision in the draft that would dictate how long those records are retained, or would it be just a bus driving around filming everything in the community all day
so
and retaining
Representative
those records forever?
Representative Barker, or Chair Barker, Representative Weininger, members of the committee, I don't see in here where it discusses provisions for record retention. I know from the practical standpoint, having worked in districts, the amount of records that we can keep in a video recording is restricted to the size of the recording. So 2-week max is kind of a typical limit in there. And some of that would depend on the way in which this camera is enacted. If we put the always running cameras on the outside of the bus, similar to what's inside the bus, then it fills that digital video recorder a little faster. If we go with one of the stop arm specific technologies out there, it's only activated once the school bus stop arm lights are activated. And that certainly is something that ODE could introduce as part of our obligation to create school bus standards by rule.
Thank you.
Okay, please. Are you
just, and it, Just a final comment, and then I'm done. Thank you for your indulgence, Mr. Chair. I don't want to lose sight of the real problem here is 1,300 right. violations a day. Mm-hmm. And as we're parsing through how this bill works, I don't, at least for myself, I don't want to lose sight of what the goal is. So I hope the department does all the department can as far as an education piece. It'd be great if there were no violations to cite for. I think that would be the optimum goal, of course. But I hope that this brings to light a greater need for education of the public and what it really means. And 1,300 violations blows me away. That's awful.
Yeah, Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I want to go back to something that was touched on before. So when we're doing serious criminal investigations, we're very careful with the video that we take, right? And we have to maintain evidentiary standards and controls. So where will these things be? Who's maintaining that control, and how do we know that that's in a secure place?
Okay. Chair Barker, Representative Gorsuch, members of the committee. Right now, we have one district that has gotten a variance to test cameras. They're not using them for any enforcement. They're doing data collection. So that setup is on a special server. It's a Springfield School District. They have a server. Members of transportation can look at the data on that server, which does include the photographs that I mentioned earlier, the location of the bus, approximate address, those details. That report can be forwarded. It's sent through a PDF, but you know, they sent me one because I said, well, you know, there's a bill coming up. I'd like to know about it. And they said, well, here it is, but I can't access any of the video because I'm not inside their firewall. So if that's the technology that goes with, school districts will have to form partnerships with their law enforcement partners, probably multiple law enforcement partners for some larger districts. Salem-Keizer, for example, has four jurisdictions to coordinate with, Keizer, Salem, and then West Polk County and Marion County, depending on where the bus is when the violation occurs. So right now that's the setup, but it certainly could be written in any manner to be stored wherever the committee feels it should be.
And one follow-up, if I could.
Please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. One other thing then, and like what was it, I want to echo what was said before. Certainly we're interested in the safety of the children, first and foremost. But you clarify this for me. So the money for this would actually come from the transportation fund in the state school system. Is that right? Not from individual districts.
So Chair Barker, Representative Gorsuch, for districts that receive state school fund, we don't dictate what is on the bus. We have some minimum standards, but what they buy on the bus is what we reimburse based on the funding statute. So this would be a reimbursable expense. So for most districts, that would be 70% of the cost to install. For Head Starts, private schools, or other entities that want to do it, they would have to absorb the costs to put it on.
One last thing.
Please.
Thank you. And sorry, but do we have an estimate of how much the cost would be for this, you know, as statewide, for instance?
So Representative Barker, Chair Barker, Representative Gorsuch, members of the committee, we don't have firm numbers. We're working with right now, going through and identifying numbers of school buses. We have about 4,900 school buses, and we're reaching out to vendors to see about approximate costs, because there's always the Cadillac of anything and the Yugo of anything.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Representative Stark.
Thank you, Chair Barker. I'm curious, maybe you said this and I missed it. Out of the 1,300 violations a day that you guys estimate, how many of those actually result in a child being injured?
So, Chair Barker, Representative Stark, members of the committee, we are pretty fortunate in this state that we don't have many injuries related to drivers going by. Part of that is the training that we mandate for both drivers and students. So the driver should always be in control of the crossing situation. So they should be directing students to cross the street and that sort of thing. So those safeguards are in place. They do seem to be working. I can also say in a number of states, this particular law is named after students. So I can't say what the future holds.
Yeah, follow up. So do we know from 2016 if we had injuries as a result of that?
Chair Barker, Representative Stark, members of the committee, we do not know of any injuries this school year or last school year as a result of this. We do require accident reports to be submitted when it happens, and I don't know of any.
Thanks.
Thank you. Okay, thank you very much for your testimony. We'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2460 and open a public hearing on House Bill 2324.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, House Bill 2324 creates a Class A violation for littering without a culpable mental state.
Nobody signed up, so yeah.
Chair Barker and committee members, good afternoon. For the record, my name is Jeff Samuels, and I'm the captain and division director for the Oregon State Police Fish and Wildlife Division. I'm here today to support House Bill 2324 and give some comments, but a little background just on the Fish and Wildlife Division. There's 120 sworn members that we have strategically located statewide. They're tasked with enforcing the fish and wildlife laws and the commercial fishing laws, as well as protecting habitats and the environment, and also providing rural law enforcement services. House Bill 2324 was introduced on behalf of the Oregon State Police to provide that Class A violation treatment to the offense. Currently, the offense of offensive littering is a Class C misdemeanor, which is punishable by a fine of not to exceed $1,250 or 30 days in jail, and or 30 days in jail. And our law enforcement officers that are out enforcing offensive littering, what they have right now is they could either issue a warning or they could issue that Class C misdemeanor for the offense. So as an example, if you had, if you're in a park situation, law enforcement observes someone that carelessly leaves behind water bottles, napkins, or fast food wrappers, what they have at their disposal to take action on that is talk to the person and issue that Class C misdemeanor, requiring them to come to court. It requires a DA to prosecute that. And the DA's, there is a statute which is, let's see, it's 161-566, which the DA's can reduce a misdemeanor down to a violation, but does cause court time. And sometimes the DA's are just deciding not to prosecute those and just concentrate on, you know, person offenses or other more serious offenses. So for this kind of minor but still substantial littering, we're trying to give law enforcement the ability to write a Class A violation, which is a $435 presumptive ticket, like a speeding ticket for those lesser offenses, and gives us more tools in our toolbox. And those people that we contact for that minor littering that should not occur in Oregon because we have such a special place and state, they're not thinking that we're overzealous in our enforcement and that we can address the situation and create compliance with some more tools so we can have that warning, that violation citation like a speeding ticket. Or in the examples where we have, you know, truckloads of household garbage being dumped on properties, you know, that proper rises to the level of a Class C misdemeanor, and we still have that ability. So that concludes my testimony. I take any questions if you have some.
Yes, I'd like to first say I think this is really an important issue before I ask my question. I think I mentioned the other day when we were dealing with the inability to aid and assist population in the state hospital, there is somebody or was somebody in the state hospital under aid and assist that was charged with littering, misdemeanor littering, and ended up in the state hospital for a long time because they weren't able to assist. I assume this would be the mental state we were talking about. But the question is, how will an officer determine the mental state?
So Chair Barker and Representative Greenlick, our fish and wildlife troopers deal with this on a daily basis currently because in the fish and wildlife laws that we're enforcing, they're all Class A misdemeanors when they're committed with a culpable mental state, knowingly, intentionally, recklessly, or with criminal negligence. However, when they're not committed with that culpable mental state or we're unable to prove a mental state, we can still issue it as a violation. And the same would occur in this circumstance. So if we're not able to be able to prove that culpability, thus no culpability. We would still, in this particular situation, have a Class A violation.
Can I follow?
Yes, you can.
I assume we're talking about mental illness in this case. Is that right? You're looking at a schizophrenic in the park tearing up paper, and that's who we hope not to have to file a misdemeanor on. Does the average law officer have the ability to make that diagnosis on the record? I would hope they can.
So, Chair Barkin, Representative Greenlake. So, as far as officers diagnosing, I'm not sure we can diagnose, but we do receive training in mental illness so that we can identify that mental illness, or hopefully identify that mental illness, and hopefully provide some avenues for help for that person.
It also, Representative, part of the thing is the mental culpability state. So if you're driving down the road and the paper in the backseat of your car blows out the window, you're not intentionally littering. If you crumble up and throw it out, you are. So there's that distinction in this as well.
I assume culpable state of mind, though, here.
If you're
probably
mentally
first.
Ill, you're probably not there.
I think this is really important.
Well, what you just described, though, Mr. Chair, is leaking, sifting load. Yeah, and that's a traffic violation. Yeah. I mean, that's not, you don't need a culpable mental state there. What are you going to do? May I ask a question?
Yeah.
Thank you. So, Captain, what happens when you're out there in the woods and you find somebody has dumped a whole pickup load full of garbage?
So,
and it happens to be a license plate in the middle of all that.
So, Chair Barker and Vice Chair Olson, this happens a lot, and our troopers glove up. They go through garbage. It's not a pleasant thing, but this is what we do. We're out there to protect the environment, and we look for all kinds of things. So it could be, you know, the codes on the bottom of a beer pop can to get us somewhere. It could be a receipt with a Visa card number. It could be, and a name maybe. It could be the license plate you describe, or other things that identify that garbage. And so we do a lot of follow-up and make some cases on misdemeanor offensive littering.
Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. When you were talking, I was thinking when I read this more along the lines, I think, where everybody else is talking about littering, garbage, et cetera. I, as soon as you said fish and wildlife, I immediately started thinking of the river that I'm on and the bottle of Potsky's, you know,
right,
eggs dropped into the water right there. But of course, there's also a couple of hooks and lines, and maybe a reel drops in, and the guy just walks off and leaves it. Mm-hmm. Would that fall under this in some way?
So, Chair Barker and Representative Post, there is another statute for littering within 100 yards of a waterway, but then you would be, you know, identifying that you're within 100 yards of a waterway. It is possible to have offensive littering near a water body under this particular statute of 164.805. You just wouldn't be proving that they were near a water body, if that makes sense.
Are you talking about chumming, Representative? I mean, that's what it sounds like. You dump your fish eggs over. Where you shame with people.
Well, I happen not to do that. But yeah, no, I what?
It's like a corn tied over the side.
But I guess I was just thinking more. I wasn't thinking about the waterway thing. Just trash, trash. And that, mm-hmm. You know, I'm a hunter and a fisher, not all are as responsible as I might be, and leave their garbage. And I'm not even thinking waterway. I'm just thinking garbage out in the open. And you said fish and wildlife, so that immediately got me thinking. Cartridges left out, boxes, you know, stuff everywhere. And I know it's hard to find somebody did that, but would that be offensive littering, I guess, is all I'm asking. It's offensive to me.
Chair Barker and Representative Post, it is offensive littering, whether it be 100 yards from waterway or not, but it is littering, and it is something that our fish and wildlife troopers and other law enforcement take care of.
It used to count as a game violation, so we'd write the 100 yards of the water, but back in the counting days. Okay. Representative,
this testimony is by the state police, but this statute applies to everywhere in the state, right? I mean, it's the
state
police.
State law, right?
Chair Barker, Representative Greenlake, yes.
Representative Weil.
Chair Barker, I just want to make sure that I heard something correctly a moment ago. Representative Olson was talking about the paper that flies out the window accidentally and somebody may not even notice it, or maybe that was the chair. That's a little bit different than fail to secure a load, for example, and I'm trying to wrap my head around whether this would reach that far down and make that kind of thing a class C felony or a misdemeanor.
I I don't think it normally would. And the officers have discretion, and you know, something blowing out of your car is different than the garbage truck with stuff coming out, and that's
sure
the leaking sifting load or rocks or gravel truck dumping rocks. So,
but when we remove the culpability, I'm worried that we've opened that all the way up.
Yeah. This isn't creating a new offense. This is reducing the offense from a misdemeanor to a violation.
To a violation for offensive littering.
So it's a softening of it rather than
the leaking load thing's different.
Okay.
Different law altogether.
Okay. So let me just ask, follow up. You're seeing this bill as creating two different stages of offensive littering, right?
Yeah.
That's
all. Reducing it. Yeah. Allowing a reduction. So that a non culpable state, you get a violation on it. Mm-hmm. Okay, here we go. One more.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Do we have anybody else signed up to testify?
No, we do not.
I'm getting confused. I thought I understood this. Any chance that Aaron Knott would be able to come up and chat about this a little bit? I think he's probably ill-prepared, sure. But...
he could. We do
context.
Have another bill to go. But yes, come on up, please, Aaron.
I'm ready to laugh.
Good.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, my name's Aaron Knott. I am the Attorney General's Legislative Director. I have no position on this bill, but I have looked at it. And I think committee counsel would be able to help out with this as well. I'll give you my personal subjective reading, which is that Class C, this would stay as a Class C misdemeanor if you have a mental state, meaning the crime was something that you did intentionally. You are aware of the fact that you are littering. You've sort of made a volitionary decision to litter. It would be a Class A violation if you do that without a mental state, which at least by my reading means there is no awareness of the fact that you have littered. There's also no minimal factor in here, so there's nothing that draws a distinction between one piece of paper or a garbage truck. It's any rubbish, trash, garbage, debris, or other refuse on the land of another without permission of the owner. It doesn't matter how much. So theoretically, at least by my reading, if you dropped a gum wrapper out of your pocket and you were not aware of it, you would commit the offense, though not the crime.
Okay, great. Okay, thank you very much. Appreciate the testimony. We will close the public hearing on House Bill 2324 and open a public hearing.
Mr. Chair, can I come up, please?
Sure.
I'm not sure what's holding this up, but I hope we'll be able to move forward with this because it seems to me a sensible solution to what could otherwise be a vaccine problem.
None of the bills are ready to go today. It's just Josh has been asleep all weekend. Open a public hearing on House Bill 2629.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2629 creates a rebuttable presumption that charges for health care services are reasonable when a district attorney presents documentation of those charges to the court in a restitution hearing. For purposes of the public hearing today, there are two amendments before you. The -2 amendment clarifies that the rebuttable presumption in the bill applies solely for the purposes of imposing restitution, while the -3 amendment expressly requires the district attorney to provide documentation of two things: number one, the services provided, and number two, the corresponding billing records. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay, thank you. Gillian Fisher and Aaron Knott. Let me start with you two again on this one.
Good afternoon, Chairman Barker, members of the committee. My name is Gillian Fisher. I am here on behalf of the Oregon District Attorneys Association. I'm a Marion County Deputy District Attorney. This bill was sponsored by the Crime Victims Law Institute. Unfortunately, neither Steve Dole nor Rosemary Brewer were able to testify. I'm here to offer my testimony in support of this bill to provide the Mr. Chair and members of the committee with some background on what the issue is and how we got here today. Essentially, the DA's office is charged with the responsibility of either during the pendency of a criminal case or at the end, when a criminal case is resolved either by plea or trial or other sort of bench trial or jury trial. We have the charge of providing the restitution amount that a victim may have incurred or an insurance company of the victim, for example, in injuries in an assault case or a vehicular assault case, any type of scenario where you can imagine medical records, or medical services being provided to a victim as a result of a crime committed against them. That usually looks, essentially, that usually is in the form of medical bills that we have either been provided from the victim directly that they have paid out of pocket. It can be from crime victims' compensation after they have reimbursed either a victim or any sort of service provider. And very often it will come from an insurance agency who has already paid for the cost of those medical services provided to a victim. In May of 2016, the Court of Appeals decided State v. McClelland, which essentially changed the way that we had been operating up until that case. We would generally just provide the documents establishing what the service that provided was and the cost that was paid for that service. Those documents would be provided along with our restitution request, and that would be our reasonable representation of the charges and the costs incurred. State v. McClelland decided that although the documents may establish the cost of the services provided, the statute requires that we also prove, according to their interpretation, that we also prove that those costs were reasonable. And by cost reasonable, it was not referring, the decision was not referring to the necessity of the medical services themselves, just the cost of those medical services. So this bill is not intended to address whether or not the medical services provided were reasonable given the harm or the association with the crime committed. This is solely to alleviate what has now become an extra burden on the DA's office to not only provide the costs as we know them to be based on medical records, but to provide extra testimony in the form of live testimonies, how we have interpreted the court's ruling, live testimony to say that those costs are reasonable for the medical services provided. And that was, as we were acting before, that was an otherwise presumptive reasonableness that no longer exists. So the intent of this bill is just to codify what we hope, what we've been using as our means of proving restitution, to say if we provide medical records that have been paid or bills from a crime victim or through crime victims' compensation, those will be presumptively reasonable unless otherwise disputed. It does not interfere with a defense ability or right to dispute the reasonableness, and at which point we would have to respond to any dispute on that reasonableness. And unless there are questions, I would just ask you to support this bill.
So let me ask, so in the thing that brought this about was, so the victim brings in a bill, and then you'd have to have the physician come in and say that, yeah, that's how much it is reasonable. And that's the problem I'm trying to subpoena docs in.
Essentially, yes, Chair Barker, members of the committee, the facts in McClelland were essentially that there was a surgery, a one-day stint in the hospital with a knee surgery, I believe, were the specific facts and the amount. The defense found the amount to be an unreasonable cost for the procedure itself, and that is essentially the court was saying that just providing the document saying this is how much the procedure costs is not enough to establish that that cost is reasonable. So you would have to bring in some sort of medical provider, hopefully a doctor who could testify that that's a reasonable price for those costs. I'm not really sure if all doctors would be able to do that, but.
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
I would really like to ask some questions. Sure. You use costs and charges interwoven here. Let me give you a hypothetical. There's no such thing as hospital charge. It's a sort of mythical, it's like the hotel rack rate that you see on the door of the hotel you're paying $100 a night for, and it says $579 is the rate. Hospital charges are very much the same way. Let's say a victim has that knee surgery, is charged $400,000 for the knee surgery, which could happen. Nobody would ever pay that $400,000. The patient wouldn't pay it, the insurance company wouldn't pay it. The insurance company might end up paying $100,000, or they might just write it off because the victim doesn't have any money. Would it be that $400,000 charge? Would that be presumed reasonable because the district attorney presented it? Is that what makes it reasonable?
Chair Barker, Representative Greenlick, we would still have to provide documentation that that is in fact what the cost of the procedure was.
But what do you mean by the cost?
Whatever it is that documentation we have is. So generally, as I said before, it's either a medical bill that the victim provides to us that they've received, or the amount that the insurance company is claiming they've paid out, or the amount that crime victims compensation. So it would be an amount either being requested by the provider that the victim, for example, may not have paid yet, or it would be an amount that has already been paid. Essentially, the answer is yes. And I guess it would not be the DA's office that is asking you to find it reasonable. We find it. Our presumption is that they're giving us a reasonable cost because they've also already paid it. That being said, nothing about this would interfere with a challenge to the restitution. Any defense attorney, if they thought that it was an unreasonable cost, all they would have to do is ask for a hearing on the issue and then present their evidence that it is, in fact, unreasonable.
Chair, may I follow up?
You may.
I mean, it would seem to me it would be reasonable if we were talking about a cost being what somebody actually paid, which is very different than a charge. I mean, I come out of the hospital, I don't have insurance, I get the $400,000 bill, I say I'm not going to pay $400,000. They say, well, how about $100,000? No, I'm not going to pay $100,000 either. Well, how about $35,000? Yeah, I'll pay that. Is the $500,000 the charge or how much somebody actually paid? Because I can live with it if somebody actually paid, either the health insurer, the individual, or somebody, which is very different than what somebody is billed in the healthcare field.
Chair Barker, Representative Greenlick, I could not say with certainty that in every scenario the bill would be paid, because, as I said, for example, if a victim has received the services but has not actually paid them yet, what they're presenting is the bills of what they're being charged, but they don't have an ability to pay, then in that scenario, it would be that they're being asked to pay this amount, and what we would be presenting are the bills that the victim is receiving.
I can guarantee you that's not reasonable in the healthcare field.
The majority of the cases that I see are crime victims' compensation or the insurance companies responding, or a victim has already paid out of pocket.
Other questions? Representative Springer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd be interested to know, and Aaron, maybe you'll have an answer to this when you testify, be interested to know how often these charges are not proven to be reasonable. Does that make sense?
Go ahead. I don't have an answer to that.
Chair Barker, Representative Springer. Could I ask you to clarify how often they are found, the charges, the amount of the charges are found to be unreasonable?
Mm-hmm.
I can say that I have only personally had to litigate the issue on one occasion, and it was not related to medical expenses. The change in the status quo is recent. It was May of 2016. So I can't say if there's very much anecdotal evidence of how often, because we were essentially functioning on a presumption of reasonableness up until that court decision. So I don't have an answer. However, I apologize. In my experience, it has not come up frequently yet.
Thank you. Thank you for clarifying.
Mr. Chairman. I'm also curious about the same questions that Representative Greenlick was asking relative to justifying something based on a charge versus an actual obligation that has been created. I think there's a difference there. I'm also trying to understand if the rebuttable presumption goes to the need for the care that was provided, not just the cost of the care provided. And I don't see anything in the way the language is currently written that would shift the burden and create a rebuttable presumption for that. Is that the intent?
The language as it's written is, as I read it, is for services provided. There is allowance in the restitution statute for future care or for ongoing care, and restitution can sometimes be amended, which is why we don't always have the exact amount at the time of sentencing. Very often we're asking for additional time, and there is a mechanism for requesting potential future, for example, counseling needs for a a victim of child abuse or things like that. I don't actually think that that is what is dealt with in this language, that this is specifically talking about an amount that we have established from services rendered to a patient, the crime victim. And I'm sorry, Mr. Chair, Representative Vile, on your first point as to the obligation versus charges, I don't know what the distinguishing factor would be for a victim who is being told that they owe this money, because for them it is an obligation. Whether they may have to negotiate it if it's not being covered, but at the time that they're receiving a bill, it's an obligation for them to pay, and an insurance company's ability to perhaps have negotiated that for different costs doesn't change the burden on the victim, which is the purpose of restitution.
Follow-up? Okay, I want to go back to the need for the charges in the first place, if I can put it that way. And these are horrific issues. I understand that victims deserve to have a method of reimbursement, but in terms of fairness, if the obligor now has the burden of proving that person really didn't need the psychological counseling that they got, that creates a very, very difficult situation. The system as we have it now, I think, puts that burden on the person claiming that they should be reimbursed for it, correct?
Absolutely, yes. And if I may, Chair Barker, Representative Vile, this bill only deals with the cost of services provider. It does not address, the presumption of reasonableness does not apply to the necessity of the services provider. That would stay the same. We would still have the burden. It would either be by stipulation that the services provided were reasonable, or we would prove it through the evidence at trial or a separate hearing that the medical services provided were reasonably needed and related to the crime. That would not change. So they're two different analyses. One would be for the cost of the services provider, and one for the need of the services themselves. The need for the services themselves, that burden is still and would remain on the state as our obligation to prove the reasonableness of them and essentially their nexus to the crime.
Thank you, Mr. Knott.
Thank you, Chair Barker, members of the committee. Again, my name is Aaron Knott. I'm the legislative director for the Attorney General at the Oregon Department of Justice. We had a technical point we wanted to make with regard to this bill. So what this bill does is it essentially says only as to the amount of charges we're going to presume reasonableness unless we have a reason not to. That's a response to a court case that seems to reverse that presumption, and it's causing a lot of medical experts to need to be brought in to substantiate what a charge amount is when before this decision, which was a 2016 decision, so we're still sort of figuring it out, but we wouldn't need to. What the Department of Justice wanted to see done here, we introduced the Dash 3 amendments, and all the Dash 3 amendments do is say that any presumption for the reasonableness of the charges will be confined to a restitution hearing only. And what we had in mind there is this victim is owed restitution, that's a relationship between the victim and the defendant. But if they end up in civil litigation, say, that they didn't receive the right kind of treatment, that the costs weren't reasonable, we would like them to get that clean slate, not be up against any sort of a presumption that those charges that were brought in a totally different court at a totally different time under a totally different legal regime should be presumed reasonable. So basically, all we're saying is we don't want to see this presumption, if the legislature should adopt it, overflow restitution and go into other contexts. So that's all that does. Since the other witness asked, I'd ask for the indulgence of the chair in taking a stab at Representative Vile's question, if that's all right.
Please.
Thank you, Chair Barker. Representative Vile. So in a restitution hearing, and this is in the bill at line six, basically the state is obligated to demonstrate the existence of economic damages. It's sort of like a civil proceeding in that way. In fact, it was created to keep victims from the trouble of going through a civil proceeding and actually having a state attorney. But that obligation to demonstrate economic damages isn't changed by this bill. So I would still need to prove, if I was the district attorney on behalf of a victim, that the economic damages suffered were reasonable, meaning they relate back to the criminality. And that's something you could absolutely litigate just as freely after the passage of this bill. All this does is say, if you've got the charges in your hand, and setting aside the issue about charging levels, but you got a piece of paper from the hospital saying, this is my bill, there's a presumption that it's reasonable. You don't need to bring in an expert to demonstrate the reasonability unless it's challenged, and then it acts as a rebuttable presumption.
Mr. Chairman, so a defense attorney's objection to a bill merely being presented, not having established the necessity of the treatment in the first place, would be sustained?
Chair Barker, Representative Vile, it wouldn't necessarily, I mean, what it would do is then trigger litigation on that point. If I was in a car accident and I was making a claim for a knee injury that didn't seem consistent with a car accident, and then, you know, it turns out that I had a bum knee, or that it pre-existed, or you had some other reason to doubt my credibility, this is something that you would litigate at a restitution hearing. So it wouldn't be accurate to say the objection would be sustained. It would just trigger that kind of a hearing about whether or not there was a factual relation between what I was charging and the nature of my victimization.
So just to make clear, the burden to establish the necessity of the treatment would be on the state, and only after that burden had been met would the rebuttable presumption relative to cost be triggered.
Chair Barker, Representative Vile, I believe that's true. You have to establish economic damages before you can even get into the question of how much you were charged for them. And I think that's consistent with the way the statute is written, which places the obligation to investigate and present the nature of any damages on the district attorney.
Mr. Chairman, I have to admit I'm still a little bit troubled by the addition of 1B that creates this presumption, feeling as broad as it does, but I'll ruminate on this a bit. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Green.
Chair, I guess I'd like to have some help from somebody. Right now the situation is a DA comes into court and says, here's a bill. The defense can say, that's not reasonable. The DA then has to prove it is reasonable. Under this, the DA comes in and presents a bill. The defense says, that's not reasonable. That's what we mean by rebuttable, I guess. But it now becomes the defense's requirement to prove that it's unreasonable, whereas before it was the DA's requirement to prove it was reasonable. Is that the correct reading of it?
Chair Barker, Representative Greenlick. Yes, except that what we were asking for the presumption to apply to is the reasonableness that's presented as it's presented in the evidence that we've provided for the restitution. So essentially, it's our evidence of the reasonableness of the cost is represented by the documents from the healthcare provider or from the insurance company of the amount paid. And if the defense thinks they're unreasonable, then at that point, we would not be required to present additional evidence as to the reasonableness. Our costs are presumed reasonable unless the defense presented something that negates that.
Let me try again, if I may. I want to make sure I understand this. Right now, the DA comes in under current circumstances and presents a bill. The defense says that's not reasonable. It now becomes the DA's responsibility to prove the evidence they're presenting is reasonable. This thing would say, under this law, the DA comes in and says, here's a bill. The defense says that's not a reasonable charge, and now it's the defense's responsibility to prove it's not reasonable, whereas before it was the DA's. You know, that's the only thing this thing does, I think. Am I reading this right?
Chairman Barker, Representative Greenlick, yes, that is correct. It would just be that they would have to provide some evidence establishing that it was an unreasonable charge.
And if I can follow up one more. Why would we want to shift the burden from the DA to the defense in this case? What's the social value of that?
Chair Barker, Representative Greenlake, I'm nervous to agree that it's a shifting of the burden because it's more has to do with an evidentiary burden. The state is just asking that the evidence reflected in the medical reports be presumed reasonable cost for the charges for the services provided, so that we wouldn't have to bring in a doctor to say those are reasonable. At which point,
the question is that in the current situation, it's the DA's responsibility to prove reasonableness if it's challenged by the defense. Under this change, it becomes the defense's responsibility to prove unreasonableness if it's presented by the DA. And I'm just wondering why we want to make that switch from the DA's responsibility to the defendant's responsibility.
Chair Barker, Representative Greenlake.
You have a lot more resources generally than the defendants have.
It would be the shift or the social benefit would essentially be to reimburse victims more easily. It is although it may seem slight to have doctors come and testify at a restitution hearing, is actually quite a substantial burden on the doctor and for our office to get them there after setting a hearing.
We have doctors anyway. The question is, who pays the bill for the doctor? Is that bill being paid by the prosecution or is it being paid by the defense? That's all this stuff. There's no magic in here because it's a rebuttable. Right? So the evidence can be rebutted. So it's now saying it's up to the defendant and some poor public defender representing the defendant to prove that it's unreasonable. That seems to me an unfair switch from the state's responsibility to the defendant's responsibility.
Chair Barker, Representative Greenlake, my only response would be it's only if they believe that their charge is unreasonable. Mm-hmm. It would be our position that that doesn't happen that often.
And you don't need the bill if it doesn't.
We would still have to prove that it's a reasonable charge anytime that they said that it was unreasonable. So it would only happen as often as they disputed it.
One more. We heard from the DAs that they're responsible for justice, for seeing justice is being done. So you need to indicate to me that the DA's position here is moving toward justice rather than away from justice. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay, thank you. Call up Gail Meyer, Mary Seal, and Sean Wiley.
Thank you, Chair Barker, Vice Chairs, and members of the committee. Gail Meyer, on behalf of the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. There's three of us up here because we were all listening with very keen ear, trying to discern from proponents exactly what it is they intended to do with the bill. And we were concerned with some of its language that we didn't quite understand exactly what it is they were trying to do with the bill. And it's been interesting to listen to the committee's debate, so I want to thank Representative Viles, Representative Greenlake for your clarifying questions. Let me just pull back up just a second here and just premise for the committee. Restitution really is a big, big deal these days. It used to be in the olden days you would just go for the victim's copay or deductible and it wouldn't be that litigated, but now they're going for the full amount, even that paid by insurers. And this is true on the property side as well as the medical side. But you can imagine when they're going for the full amount of medical charges, that these can be tens of thousands of dollars. And this converts to a judgment that is good for 20 years. It's collected. There can be garnishments. It far exceeds almost any other condition of probation that impacts the accused. So restitution really is a very big deal. In the context of proving restitution, the government historically has always had the burden of proof with respect of every little element, and that's that the defendant committed the crime, that the crime caused injury. There's a causal relationship there, that it's but for the crime, there would not have been an injury. In the instance of medical damages, then this injury must have resulted in economic damages. And when it comes to medical economic damages, which is all this bill addresses, there are two parts, as Representative Viles was pointing out. Number one, that the services rendered were necessarily incurred. And number two, that those charges were reasonable. And when we listened to the proponent, there's a bit of conflation, but actually I think I heard Ms. Jillian Fisher say, we're only attempting to establish the rebuttable presumption as to the charges, not as to whether or not the medical services were necessarily incurred, necessarily rendered. The problem with that, though, is that having the burden shift on just one side doesn't really relieve the government of very much, because if the accused is to say this whole thing is unreasonable, they're going to have to bring in a medical provider to prove that the services were necessarily rendered. And so it's hard to see, getting back to Representative Greenlick's point, what's the social value in putting the burden on the defendant as to the reasonableness of the costs kind of eludes us. The Dash 2 amendment was ours. It was attempted to at least clarify what the phrase means by documentary evidence. What often happens is a practitioner like Ms. Sell might get an email a day or two before the restitution hearing. Victim says their charges are $19,785. That's what we'll be asking for. That couldn't be, we would hope, appropriate documentation of the charges. So at a bare minimum, it thinks that the government needs to present the medical records themselves and the actual billing records associated with the medical records before there could ever be a discussion of having a rebuttable presumption shift over. What we understand the DOJ attempting to do with the Dash 3 is to clarify that this rebuttable presumption does not apply on the civil side. Again, I would reference Representative Greenlick's question, then what's the social value of having the criminal defendant do it on the criminal side? If it's not going to have any impact on the civil side, when they have greater discovery rights, why should it apply on the criminal side to the criminal defendant? So it is important to underscore that in the context of criminal restitution, the victim retains their medical privilege. It's not waived. In a civil case, if a plaintiff files a civil case saying, I've been injured and I want medical damages as a result of my injury, that plaintiff waives their medical privilege as it relates to that condition. There's all sorts of discovery that goes on. The defendant is entitled to get their medical records, they're deposed, they get to look at all that in an exhaustive way. On the criminal side, the victim does not waive their medical privilege. So if the defense attorney were to pick up the phone and say to the practitioner, can I please talk to you about the charges you charged, Ms. Jones, they would assert HIPAA, and they would say, can't talk to you, can't even acknowledge to you we treated her at all. So there's only one way in which the defense could ever have access to that evidence, and that would be to subpoena those people and bring them in for a hearing. So in our view, if there were to be a burden shift, which is what this is, to the accused, you would, the unintended consequence is the defense would have to start subpoenaing all these medical practitioners into the courtroom for a restitution hearing, and you'd have more hearings rather than fewer hearings. So there's that. The other thing is that there is a bit of a cost shift with this. If there is supposed to be any medical expert to talk about whether or not charges are reasonable or not, if the burden shifts to the defense, in most instances you have an indigent defense provider. Those experts, those costs would be borne by the state fund through the Office of Oregon Public Defense Services, whereas right now those costs rest with the county district attorney. So that's sort of the big overview. Ms. Sell here has some examples of why these hearings are necessary, and then Mr. Wiley is here also to make some comments.
Hello, Chair Barker, Vice Chair Olson, and Vice Chair Williamson, members of the committee. My name is Mary Sell. This is the first time that I've appeared in front of you, so I'm just going to briefly introduce myself so you have an idea of who I am. Over the past 5 years, I've practiced civil law in the area of family law. I've also practiced private retained criminal defense as well as court-appointed work, and most recently I was a public defender at Metropolitan Public Defender. I'm now here in front of you as a legislative representative with GAIL for the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. Gail's right. The reason why I'm here today is because I did want to just kind of briefly give an overview of why are restitution hearings necessary and why is restitution a big deal. So often, defendants often do plead guilty or they're found guilty if they have a trial, and a lot of times they agree to restitution. I think everyone here can agree that making sure that victims are compensated is an important piece of the criminal process puzzle. However, there are many reasons why, after a guilty plea or after a conviction in a trial, a defendant would request a hearing on restitution. A lot of times, restitution requested by the state is presented, like Ms. Meyer talked about, in an email or a document created by the DA or the victim's rights advocate, and not actual medical records. In fact, often I would say that we're not receiving those documents, and we're not often receiving billings. Sometimes it's not clear that the restitution requested is foreseeable, which is a piece of this. Sometimes the injury or harm is incredibly attenuated from the actual criminal act, and that starts to kind of get into the piece about whether or not the services rendered were actually reasonable. Again, the bill in front of you is not touching that based on what we've heard, but that is something that definitely comes up and is definitely litigated probably most often. And then much less if the costs themselves are reasonable, and that's what the bill is supposed to be touching right now. As we know, defendants have due process rights to have hearings where a judge gets to hear the evidence. This restitution hearing is similar as a trial where the DA's office actually has the burden. The case law doesn't come out and necessarily say it, but the burden is lower in a restitution hearing, most likely a preponderance of the evidence, so not beyond a reasonable doubt. So it already is easier for the state to prove this connection and that the defendant should pay restitution. So they're already working off of a lower burden. So sometimes restitution is small. I personally have had many cases where the action and the injury caused by the defendant is small, even medium, sometimes big, where the defendant's like, yep, I'm pleading guilty to this, and it makes sense that I need to pay back for the property damage that I caused, or the physical injury that I caused. And I have many clients just agree flat out to restitution. So a lot of times hearings aren't necessary. Sometimes restitution is quite significant. And then earlier when I testified and explained kind of these reasons why we would have a hearing, I guess the next piece to kind of show you is what do these restitutions look like? What are these fact patterns? So I have two examples for you. One is a medical example, and this one is a good example of why the state would still need to prove services rendered were necessary and reasonable, and then we can kind of examine it and look at it from the perspective of this bill, that they have to prove that the charges are reasonable. Ms. Meyer and I are part of a wonderful group of people who all convene on a listserv called The Pond. And when we were preparing for this and when we're preparing for, as a defense attorney, when we're preparing for trials, we always kind of send out little messages to each other to talk about, hey, has anybody ever encountered this? So I sent out a missive requesting some stories, and one of our members sent me this story. This is a case where the defendant was in the middle of a contentious divorce. She was in a family law court, and slapped her soon-to-be ex-husband's new girlfriend. One slap across the face. Obviously a criminal act, and we're not condoning that by any means. She did, in fact, plead guilty to that charge. She didn't have a trial. She pled to misdemeanor assault in the fourth degree. They did request a restitution hearing, though. The reason was the request was close to $15,000, and again, this was for one slap across the face. This wasn't a ground-and-pound MMA fight. The victim in the case had extensive dental reconstruction done to both sides of her face, and my understanding, based on my communication with our member, was that this was just one slap on the side of one side of the face. But the victim had extensive dental reconstruction done to both sides of her face, and replaced some of her bridges or half-rotten teeth with dental implants, which are much more expensive and arguably unnecessary. Again, the bill in front of you, based on what Ms. Fisher said, is not touching that. However, as you can see, these things do come up, and they're quite important. In the end, in that case, the judge heard the case and actually cut the restitution down to half, to about $7,000. And so I think that this is a good example simply to show why are hearings had, what kind of issues come up, and why should there be essentially a dialogue about what's being charged, and why should there be a conversation, as Representative Greenlick posited, that these costs are in fact reasonable. And so those are two questions, but they're questions that there really should be evidence presented on so that the fact finder, the judge, can make a reasonable decision. So not only is it a fair outcome for the victim, but also a fair outcome for the defendant, who has a due process right to be able to litigate these things and to have a hearing and to have a judge make a decision based on evidence and based on information. Now, the next example is much shorter, and I'm going to try to wrap up quickly. This is what I call the egg against the RV case. Another member of our a group of membership told me this story. It's a pending case currently where he has an elderly client, defendant, who got into an argument with one of their neighbors, and this elderly client threw a single egg at the side of the RV of of the victim. The defendant was charged with criminal mischief in the third degree, a lower level misdemeanor. The restitution request has come in. The restitution request is for $10,000 for the RV, which on its own has a value of only a few thousand dollars. The question that we probably all have is, what? $10,000 for one egg? If you re-detailed the entire RV, it's possible that the cost could be more than it's worth. But the question is, did the whole RV need to be re-detailed, or did the one spot that had the egg splatter need to be specially cleaned? And specially cleaning the RV could cost some money, but not $10,000. And so we fully expect that there's going to be a hearing on the egg against the RV case. And what's going to be looked at is the service. Was that necessarily incurred? Is there a nexus? Was there some foreseeability? While this is not a medical case, I think that it could still kind of be looked at from the way that this bill is modifying the law. What cost is reasonable to clean the one patch where the egg was thrown? So the bottom line, and Ms. Meyer spoke on this, is, and this is my our membership's position, but also my personal opinion, based on my practice, we will have more hearings in these instances because the state will be shifting their burden to prove that costs are reasonable to the and the defense is going to have to disprove that or to disprove the reasonableness. We will have more hearings because we do not have access to the victims or their records. Our only option will be to subpoena the medical professionals and their records at great expense to not only their time, but to state funds. This is why the Dash 2 amendment that we have put forth would be necessary to make sure the defense is afforded the appropriate information to either resolve the claim, which is many times ideal for all parties involved, or to appropriately and adequately prepare for the hearing, especially if the defense will need to rebut that the costs themselves are reasonable. And again, our perspective is that the medical records and the billing records would need to be provided to the court and necessarily the defense, as it would become the discovery the state is obligated to provide to the defense at least 10 days prior to the hearing, which in my experience doesn't always happen. Thank you, members of the committee. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you. Please go ahead.
Yes, Chair Barker, Vice Chair Olson, Vice Chair Williamson, members of the committee. My name is Sean Wiley, and I'm a criminal appeals attorney with the Office of Public Defense Services. I'm testifying before you today as co-chair of the OCDLA Legislative Committee. I'll be very brief. The conversation has been pretty extensive. I just really wanted to put some of this in context, specifically State versus McClellan and what exactly that opinion dealt with, since that seems to be the focus of the proponents, is fixing that. Economic damages is what we're talking about, and it's defined by ORS 31.710. And I'm going to read it because I think it clarifies a lot, because there's confusion with regard to reasonableness. It conveys a couple different meanings. One, whether or not the charges should have cost as much as they did. This service costs this much. There's another kind of meaning of reasonableness that comes to mind, which is whether they were necessary, whether this was reasonably incurred by the victim after seeking medical assistance as a result of the crime. So economic damages is defined as objectively verifiable monetary losses included but not limited to reasonable charges necessarily incurred for medical, hospital, nursing, et cetera. So there's two components there. One is whether or not they're reasonable. This is what it should cost. The other is whether it's necessarily occurred. And McClellan only dealt with the reasonableness. In other words, this procedure costs this much money. And you can see that there's a footnote in the opinion that says the trial court in McClellan, correctly noted that it was undisputed that the victim was injured by the defendant, incurred the medical bill, and the victim's surgery was necessary. Regardless, as discussed above, economic damages still requires proof that the charges for the hospital services were reasonable. In other words, that was the only issue present in McClellan. So to the extent that the bill is addressed to that issue alone, I think that significantly narrows kind of the focus, although the concerns raised by Representative Greenlick in the earlier questioning still remain as far as like what costs are in that range. I would also like to note that the Dash 2 amendment, which clarifies kind of the type of documentation that this body envisions meeting that presumption, is necessary for a number of reasons. One, I think it clarifies some of the issues that are discussed today. The other is that if it's left open, I can tell you, I mean, similar to what Ms. Sell was saying as far as greater hearings, I think that what, in fact, I'm pretty sure you'd see my office and the Department of Justice, the Attorney General's office, their appellate division, battling out over what documentation is sufficient. Is it a slip of paper? Is it a note, an email? Is it an actual hospital, et cetera? So without clarification by this body, we'll be going back and forth, and the Court of Appeals and Supreme Court would have to kind of discern what was meant in the bill by documentation. So I urge this committee to consider that carefully.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So to kind of summarize, not that we need a summary, of course, but to summarize, so we have a defendant, and we have a defendant who's been convicted in court. And the burden of proof for that conviction was on the state. And restitution is mandated by the state. So now this bill would say, but except for that part, the burden of proof will be on the defense. Is that correct? Okay, go ahead.
Yeah. Chair Barker and Representative Gorsuch, yes, we do see it shifting the burden of proof. And burden of proof is almost always placed on the party that has the superior access to the evidence.
Right.
That's the important part here. And especially when you're talking about medical records, the defendant is the party least entitled to have access to those medical records.
Yeah. Thank you. And one last thing. So my concern about all of this is that we say state gets, or defense gets a lawyer, defense gets a vigorous defense against the state, and then at the end we go, well, except that for the restitution, they'll have to basically do that. I mean, it seems like the burden of proof should stay the whole time with the state and not flip because of the restitution question. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Somebody else have a question?
No.
Okay. Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
We'll close the hearing on House Bill 2629.
Thank you.
For the business coming before the committee, we stand adjourned. Thank you, committee. Adjourned. Thank you, committee.